County. If you are a guest, we want to get you there on Wednesdays, and so you're going to be under a lot of friendly pressure to come and join us. We have a lovely time there. We love the Lord. We love each other. And it's one of the great blessings in my life to be a part of that outreach and that ministry. We want to thank Melissa and Dale for letting us be in their beautiful new house. Was the founder of the Bible study, and it's been going on, I don't know, 24 years now? But anyway, it's a phenomenon. And I also want to thank Catherine, who has been doing, Catherine Hanley, who's been administering and doing all these wonderful things. Of course, Ivy Scanlon. Okay. It's also my pleasure and honor to introduce our speaker today, and I have to do this because she's a woman of many parts, and I don't want to forget any of them that might be pertinent this morning. Once upon a time, I want to say, there was a beautiful young woman, a stunningly beautiful young woman named Jenny McDonald, but the world knew her and probably drooled over her on the covers of Vogue as Winsor Elliott, who was a Vogue model and who was living a very glamorous life. But once upon a time, she saw that that life didn't have everything in it that she yearned for. And at a certain point, she was reading the Bible, and this verse was quickened to her. If you've ever had that experience of somebody just jumping off of the page, it says, "What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul?" And she realized she wanted to have the soul. She already had the world. So she's now Jenny Guinness, having married Oz Guinness, who's a wonderful writer, intellectual, Christian apologist, a wonderful Christian man. And she was not only on the cover of Vogue, but of countless other magazines. And she's very fun to Google because she's just amazing, just a work of art. Anyway, she still has stunning good looks, and the world loves her for that, but also for her. I'll go with you. The wisdom and wit of Jenny. And this part I have to thank Heidi for writing, because I have not gotten to know Jenny the way I would like to. We have a mutual friend who's very close, and I wanted to tell Jenny, if I may insert this, when I was a new Christian, and our mutual friend and I were having a supportive coffee every Saturday morning, because we had little kids and our husbands kept them, and so we could just go and talk seriously. And hearing the story of this beautiful model who had just kind of walked away from that and walked toward the center of everything was so encouraging to me at that time of my life. And so Jenny doesn't know this, but I'm going to be one of the 500 million people in heaven who are going to come up and say thank you. I guess I've just said it. So she didn't have any idea of that. Heidi says, "We love Jenny because of her love for Jesus and for others. She's long had a passion to see the local church intersect with the marketplace. From New York to Embassy Row, she has used her great influence to give people an encounter with the love of Jesus Christ." And Heidi says this, she won't tell you this, Jenny won't tell you this, but she's one of the leading intercessors in Washington, D.C. She has a deep commitment to partner with the Lord in prayer, is passionate about praying for our children and for future generations as well. She's a student of prayer and revival. She's a heroine of the faith to us. She's a brilliant writer and communicator and has a winsome ability to dialogue about faith and love in the most non-threatening ways. Jenny and her husband founded the Trinity Organization and have served on numerous other boards. She's long been a friend to this group, and we love her, and we know you will too. So Jenny, please come on. Back there, but there's an amplifier, so plenty can hear. So I know we'll accommodate. So bless you. So glad to have you.
I don't know if I can live up to that introduction. It is such a privilege to be here. Can you all hear me? I'm sort of struggling with issues as they're telling me.
if you can. It's a great delight to be here. I am a great admirer of the Georgetown Women's Bible Study, even if it does things right and in depth. And I'm just very honored to be here today with you all. Can you all
louder?
Can you all see my
louder?
Louder. Okay. Heidi invited me to come today to either share a Christmas story or something of my favorite traditions of Christmas or a bit of my life. So, of course, I'm going to do both. I hope that's all right. Everybody has great Christian and Christmas traditions. And if they're not a Christian, they still have great Christmas traditions. And mine are both, even though I'm not at all musical, are both about music. When Oz and I lived in Oxford, we used to listen to carols from Kings, the lessons and carols, every Christmas Eve on the BBC. So I love that. I love the Messiah, Handel's Messiah, whether it's coming from the Royal Albert Hall or it's just soaring around my kitchen while I'm making mince pies. So I'm going to share a tiny bit today about how Handel wrote his Messiah, if that's all right. And I should tell you the reason I love both of those pieces of music are because both of them trace the whole extraordinary many millennia narrative from the beginning of creation all the way through to the consummation of history. And the next time you listen to Lessons and Carols, and the next time you listen to Handel's Messiah, listen for that narrative. I probably appreciate it so much because I didn't know about that narrative until I was an adult. I grew up in California. My mother had a guru, her own private guru. And I might as well have come from Mars for all I knew about the biblical narrative. So I'm going to begin with a little bit of sharing about Handel, and then I'm going to share a little bit about how his music intersected my life. The phenomenon, I have to use notes for this too, the phenomenon of Handel's Messiah defies really any description. For 2.5 centuries, it has been the most performed musical composition. It's raised the most money, and it's probably brought the most people to faith. One of his biographers said, "Messiah has fed the hungry, clothed the naked, and fostered the orphan more than any other single musical composition." And another historian said, "Messiah has probably done more to convince thousands of mankind that there is a God than all the theological works put together." George, and there are copies of this little book I have around if you want to have them and take it home there for you. George Friedrich Handel was born in Germany in 1685. And as a young composer, he was famous for Italian opera. He was praised by royalty. He was adored around Europe. He had thunderous applause in all his concerts. And he moved to London in the midst of all this fame, and then the Italian opera lost favor, and the English oratorio came into fashion. And he then suddenly was finding himself struggling to master this genre. And the appreciation of him was dropping, and fewer and fewer people coming to his concerts. And when he wrote The Messiah, he was at the very lowest point in his life. He was 56 years old. He was deeply discouraged. He was ill. He had terrible debt and was facing the possibility of debtor's prison. And on top of all that, he had a stroke which rendered his right hand, which he composed with and performed with, practically immobile. And all of his friends believed that his life and his career were finished. And then two remarkable things happened. He was offered a commission to write an oratorio for a Dublin charity performance. And at the very same time, a friend of his, a wealthy friend of his, who had written a libretto, asked him to write the music, the score for the libretto. And the libretto, as this man, I will read this quote, he said, I may it be that Handel excel all his former work as the subject on this libretto excels every other subject. The subject is Messiah. So Handel set to this work in this very, very depressed state. He did not come out of his house for 3 weeks. He hardly ate any food. The friends who came to visit him would find him sobbing with emotion. The servant who tried to get him to eat came in to bring him food, and he looked up at the servant and said, I feel I have seen all of heaven open and the great God himself. Wow. He was so moved and so stirred, he wrote the Messiah, 260 pages of musical manuscript in 24 days.
Wow. So the next time, listen to remember that amazing feat.
So it was written in 3 weeks, and it's written in three parts. The first part looks at the beginning of the biblical narrative, all the Old Testament prophecies of the coming Messiah. The second part looks at the life, the birth, the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And the third part looks at that great acclamation at the consummation of all history, the returning of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, the second coming. So those are the three parts. And I want to read you from Handel's own work, if I may, but I'm going to break in the narrative to just now tell you a little bit of my own personal story, and then I'll bring the two together. You know more about my life than I thought you would know. So I'm going to plunge you in without explanation to a moment in my life. This moment begins at a party in Paris, Cécile, at the Maurice Hotel, in the apartments of Salvador Dali, who had permanent apartments in the Maurice Hotel of Paris. It's 1970. I'm wearing a gold-encrusted caftan. I'm with my fiancé, who is a French baron. We have just shot my fourth Vogue cover. And the guests at this party are the Rothschilds, the von Furstenbergs, the Picassos, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, et cetera, et cetera. And at this party, with people milling and the men all wearing gold-encrusted navy jackets, remember, the late 60s, the early 70s, those who lived then will remember. It was all about fantasy and over-the-top everything. So Salvador Dali had a cheetah, a pet cheetah, and there are many famous pictures of him walking this cheetah up and down the halls of the Maurice Hotel. And at this party, I was watching the cheetah. And I mean, I went to these parties all the time. This wasn't anything new for me, but I got sort of affixed on this, watching this cheetah. And I realized that he had been detoothed and declawed, and I'm sure de-everything else. And he was on a long gold diamond-encrusted chain, pacing between playwrights and royalty, and pacing back and forth in this party. And I watched him, and I thought, you know, this magnificent animal is a caricature of what he was created to be. Mm-hmm. And then I looked around the room, and I just felt like I was looking into an abyss of absurdity and meaninglessness. And so after that party, I went back to New York where I lived, and we commuted every weekend, and I started a spiritual search And I went to psychics, I went to gurus, I knocked on doors, I talked to anyone who would talk to me about, is there any meaning in the universe? Is there any meaning to anything? Is this all absurd? And at the end of that year, I had progressed no further than when I had started. I had no answers. I was unwilling to look at one religion, and that was the Christian faith, because I thought it was bourgeois, I thought it was very uncool and legalistic, and also I'd seen some of those terrible televangelists on television. So I thought, I don't even have to look at that religion, I always know. So at the end of that year of really dogged search, whenever I had free time, I was walking up Park Avenue and I just looked up at the night sky and I said, I give up, I quit. And then I said, you know, if there's a God, I can't find you, will you find me? Wow. That was my prayer. So very quickly, two things happened. One is, I had visitors come to my apartment that I didn't know. It was one of these random friend of friends things. They came to my apartment. He was a scientist, a physicist, and she was a voiceover actress, so she knew my world. They were young. They were probably in their mid-30s. I was 20, maybe 21. And so I entertained them. And then in the course of the time of being in my apartment, they saw one of my Vogue covers. And they both gasped. And I said, you know, why did you gasp when you looked at that cover? And they said, because this is really extraordinary. They said, we're Christians, they said. And immediately all my everything goes up. Oh no. We're Christians. And 6 months ago we were in Seattle and we were going to a prayer meeting and we went to a supermarket to buy coffee on the way to the prayer meeting. And as we're going through the queue, the checkout, the Lord spoke to our hearts and said, buy that magazine and pray for the girl on the cover.
Wow.
So they had been praying for me for 6 months.
Oh, wow.
Now I had just prayed on the street. I can't find you. If you exist, will you find me? So, having exhausted everything else, I then pummeled this couple with my questions. And they were the only answers that ever made sense to me. The only answers that answered the whole spectrum of my questions, not just part. Every religion I looked at answered a little piece of it, but not the whole spectrum. It wasn't integrated. It didn't make sense in a whole picture. And it didn't hurt that this man was a scientist. And it didn't hurt that his wife was a model. So in the course of knowing them and asking them questions and battling through tons and tons of Q&A periods, I became a Christian. Right after that, a neighbor of mine, a friend, I lived in this amazing townhouse with three levels, turn of the century, high ceilings and huge marble fireplaces, and was divided into three apartments. Every floor was an apartment. So the people that lived upstairs from me, I would meet on the staircase as I was rushing to and from my bookings. And the woman was always trying to tell me something and I never had time to listen to her. And after I became a Christian, I was on the stairs one night rushing home from a booking and digging for my keys. And I felt like the Lord said to me, this woman is really hurting and I want you to pay attention to what she's telling you. So I put my bags down and I said, Esther, tell me what it is. And so she told me the tale of her brother. She was elderly. Her brother was elderly. He'd been the paterfamilias of the whole family, this big Jewish family. He'd invested all their funds, earned a fortune for them, mentored the children and the grandchildren. He was adored. He had a stroke 3 years earlier, and he was a vegetable. He was in a coma. He was in limbo. He couldn't die. He couldn't live. They had lost him, but his illness was drinking a six-figure hospital bill, you know, constantly eating up all the money he'd earned for them. And she said, it's not really the money. She said, the thing that is just so sad is when we go to see him, he looks so tormented, and yet he had all these tubes, and he's He's in this coma, he's in limbo, and we want him to be able to go, to die. He loved God, he was a great lover of God as a Jew. So I listened to her story, and I really didn't, you know, pay much attention. And then about 2 days later, I felt the Lord saying, I want you to go and pray with Mr. Goldstein. And the idea, instead of being abhorrent to me, was like, yes, of course. Why didn't I think of that? That's exactly what I wanted to do. So, which is very unusual for who I was then. So I said to Esther, I want to go pray with your brother. And she said, oh, no, you don't. She said, it's grotesque. I wouldn't dream of letting you go. And all these tubes, and he looks like a ghoul, you know. And plus the fact that the hospital is in Queens, which is an hour drive from Manhattan in a taxi. And I said, Esther, I hear you, but I just really want to go. I won't push if you don't want me to, but I just want to so much. And she saw that I meant that. So she allowed me to go. And so I got my brand new Bible. I got in a taxi, hour out to Queens. And then I thought, what am I going to pray? I don't know the Bible. I've never studied the Bible. I don't know anything. What am I going to pray with this man? Besides that, he's in a coma. What are you doing? So I got to the hospital. Before I left, I had a screenplay writer friend who heard of what I was doing. He thought I'd gone completely off the deep end anyway when I became Christian. And he heard about what I was doing, and he said, don't leave till I get there. So he came, and he went with me to Queens. He was sitting watching all this. He wrote Kansas and a lot of other films you would have seen. Anyway, so I realized that what I want to say to him is in the Messiah. It's all in the Messiah. So I read him passages from my Bible that were from Messiah that I knew. I dug and dug and dug for them. I know it's somewhere in the book of Isaiah. Found them, read them to him, and I said, and I just felt the most incredible love for this man. Wow. Just incredible love for him. And I said, Mr. Goldstein, I pray that the Lord would open his spirit to hear what I was saying, even though he was in a coma. And I said, Mr. Goldstein, these are your Jewish scriptures. This is about Messiah, and I believe his name is Jesus, and he loves you so much, and he has his hand extended to you, and if you will take his hand, he will take you home. So at the end of that time, I just felt the love of God so strongly for this man. So at the end of that time, Spencer and I went out to have a steak pommes frites salad, and Spencer said, I think you've completely lost your mind. I said, probably. The next day, I came back from a booking, and there was a note under my door, and it was from Esther. And she said, I don't know what miracle occurred at the hospital last night, but my brother died in the early hours of the morning with a look of the most radiant joy on his face. And she said, every member of the family who has come to the hospital has remarked on it. And she said, I want you to know we believe it's a miracle. Well, people do hear things in comas. You can argue different ways about that. I believe it was a miracle. I believe an even greater miracle was the self centered 21-year-old going an hour to Queens Hospital. I believe it was all a miracle. And what I wanted to do, the thing I really, really think is the miracle, again, is the biblical narrative, is the story that we're all wrapped up in. And so now I just want to read like a phrase. Do I have time to read like a phrase from each of the three parts of Handel's Messiah? And then I'm almost finished. Okay. Now, one other thing I wanted to say here. In Switzerland, we lived in Switzerland before we lived in England. And in Switzerland, we could look out of our window and see the Alps. When you look at the Alps from a ground perspective, they look like they are all one mountain range.
But in fact, if you were in an aircraft or you got in a car and drove, there's range number one, and then the whole Rhone Valley before you get to range number two, and then half of Italy before you get to range number three. But the perspective telescopes these mountain ranges into one thing. And that's the way biblical prophecy is. So you see prophecies that are pointing ahead hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years and talking about the event as if it's already happened. So from the first segment, and this is what I shared with Mr. Goldstein, behold, I want you to know this was written 800 years before Jesus was born. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel, God with us. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light, and they that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them has the light shined. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. And of the increase of his government, there will be no end. The second part of the Messiah describes the birth, the death, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Am I still there?
Yeah.
The part I'll read to you, you're all very familiar with, but think of it again, written 800 years before the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. He was despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. He was wounded for our transgressions, and he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. That section ends with these words: he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgressions of thy people he was stricken. But you did not leave him in death, nor suffer him to suffer corruption. And then it goes on. Lift up your heads. You've got the resurrection. You've got the crucifixion and the resurrection 800 years ahead. Lift up your heads, O ye gates. Lift up your heads, ye everlasting doors. And the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. And then that's followed by the Hallelujah chorus, which you all know so well. And then the third and last section begins, I know that my Redeemer liveth. We all know that. I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the last day upon the earth. And then it goes on into the New Testament. I won't read it all, but I'll just read the first phrase. Since by man came death, by man came also the resurrection of the dead. For as in Adam all died, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. And then it goes on to the trumpets shall sound, all the pieces you know so well. King of kings and Lord of lords, worthy is the Lamb who was slain. You know, the glorious ending of the third movement of the Messiah.
So, just going back to Mr. Goldstein and these amazing mountain ranges, I always love the fact that Oz talks about this, but it's not original with him. I don't know who it is original with, but how we live, we who are Christians, live really between the second mountain range and the third, because the cross has happened behind us. And so he calls that living in the no longer, but the not yet. The no longer, but the not yet. So going back to finish with Handel here, I'm really finished now. On the final page of his manuscript, he wrote the initials SDG, Sola Deo Gloria, to God alone be the glory in Latin. Many musicians have considered him in a class by himself. Haydn said he is the master of us all. Mozart wrote, when Handel strikes, he strikes a thunderbolt. Beethoven, when asked who was the greatest composer of all time, said, Handel. Handel, to him I bow the knee. Beethoven said that about Handel. Handel wanted to die at Easter time. And he died the day after Good Friday and the day before Easter Sunday.
Wow.
In the no longer, but the not yet. Over 3,000 people attended his funeral in Westminster Abbey. And there's a marvelous statue of him there holding the script of the third part of the Messiah with the words you can read on the statue, I know that my Redeemer liveth.
Ooh. Wow.